Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Kate Moss talking about the French wars of religion in the burning chambers.
Well, thank you all so much, and well done for getting out of the tent. I didn't think there'd be anybody here, so I'm delighted to see so many of you. But I have to be absolutely honest. When I was asked if I would do a talk to this expert audience on the wars of religion, I did balk a little bit, because I'm not a historian. I'm a storyteller, and I write history that's inspired, personal history, stories made up, imaginary characters against the backdrop of real history. But of course, then what the founders of the festival said to me is, yes, there will be people in the audience who know more than you do about the wars of religion. And if you'd like to put your hands up now, I will direct my attentions elsewhere. But what he then said was, but many people come to history by reading novels. And sometimes by reading novels, they then go to the real history, as it were, and discover all the detail and the granular stuff and the things that actually happened. And he also said, people want to know why any writer would choose to make stuff up in front of the real history as well, rather, I suppose, than writing the straightforward history itself. So in the end, I agreed. And I agreed, and I have some slides. Now, you are used to slides. Novelists don't have slides. So this might all go catastrophically wrong. But I think the thing that matters for me is that everything that I've written in terms of storytelling is inspired by place. And it's inspired by that idea that it's not just the nature of the landscape and the lightscape and the sound, it's also the history that happened there and the way that history influences how you tell your stories and what you might decide to put on the page and what you keep off the page. So The Burning Chambers is a quartet of novels. It's a Romeo and Juliet story, if you will, a Catholic family and a Protestant family, a Huguenot family, 300 years of history, starting in 1562 on the eve of the wars of religion that will destroy France, and finishing in 1862 on the other side of the world in a place called Franschhoek in South Africa. Now, one of the things that people often ask when you write in this field or you work in this field, and those of you who are descended from Huguenots or you know this period of history well, one of the things before I even started researching the book was, where does the word Huguenot come from? And of course, like with so many of these names and words, we're not sure. Everyone has a slightly different point of view, but we know it could be from the Flemish, which is Hisgenuten, or the German Eidgenossen. I can't speak either of these languages. Or it could even be from Besken and Hugh, who was a religious leader working with Calvin in Geneva. They called themselves members of the Église Réformée, Reformed Church. I have used the word Huguenot because in the same way I use the word Cathar in my Languedoc trilogy, particularly Labyrinth, it's the word that means something to all of us now. But in the end, they are the French Protestants. The one thing we do know, and it's rather wonderful because this is a diaspora novel and it's 300 years of what it means to have to leave your home and find yourself on the other side of the world, that the word refugee comes from the French réfugié, and it was the word that was used when the Huguenots first started to pour into London to describe them. And that is the one thing that I think is rather wonderful and the Huguenot Museum has talked about. And so one of the things that I suppose as a historical writer, a writer of historical fiction, imagined characters set against the backdrop of real history, is that idea, that wonderful thing I've always had in the back of my mind, said by the Goncourt brothers, which is history is a novel that has been lived. A novel is history that could have been. And you will see here the Huguenot cross, and I've just seen a wonderful necklace from the lady over there. And the Huguenot cross again, when did it become the Huguenot cross? It looks very similar to the Cathar cross, to the Occitan cross. There are ideas that possibly it was taken from some sort of symbol that the great French king Henri IV had. But again, when you're a novelist, it doesn't matter. What matters is that the story that comes from that object that you have in your hand and the way that the object makes any of you feel as readers when you look at it. So The Burning Chambers itself is the first novel in the quartet, and it is set within the first year of the War of Religion. It's just set in 1562. And I thought, though, it would be helpful just to put it up there on the screen, that the Wars of Religion are a sequence of what you might call civil wars. When you read French history and American history and British history, the historians, the real historians of this era, don't entirely agree quite how many wars there were, because some could be, you know, armed peace. Is that a war as well? Some are clearly ceasefires. Maybe that shouldn't be counted separately. But for all intents and purposes, when you're writing historical fiction, it's the sense of the sequence that matters. And that they started on the 1st of March in 1562, and they were brought to an end on the 13th of April 1598 by the signing of the Edict of Nantes. And we will get to the end of that as we go through this storytelling. But one of the things that mattered to me about this was not simply the sequence of dates and the things that happened in the real history, if you like, at the top, but the things that had led up to it. Because although it started on that day, on the 1st of March 1562, and that is seen as the first engagement, of course there had been wars and rumblings going on for some time. The drizzle of discontent between the Huguenots and the Catholics, at court in particular, and in the cities, was rumbling on for a long time before that. And one of the things that was interesting to me as a novelist was the role that printing and words played in this. Now, all of you who know the causes of the disagreements, the theological disagreements, if you like, rather than the military disagreements between the Catholics and the Huguenots, will know one of the things seems so extraordinary to us now, I would say, that the idea that to worship in your own language was radical and dangerous, and in the end could be punished by death. But those of you who've read Labyrinth will know that the possession of a Cathar New Testament in Occitan by the end of that engagement was punishable by death. Because, of course, it's never really quite about the doctrine. It's never really quite what it means to want to speak the words to God in French rather than Latin. It is about influence and power and control. And of course, what you have in that period of time is printing is becoming widespread. More people are reading than ever before. It is the era in the 16th century of bookshops. And of course, as a novelist, all the best stories start in a bookshop. And indeed, my lead character is the daughter of a bookseller. And so there has been the Bible in Wittenberg from 1534, and then, of course, by 1545, the Lutheran Bible. There is the work of the great Lefebvre and the Antwerp Bible, and that is revised and revised until we finally have the Geneva Bible in 1588. And you have the great and important translation of the Psalms into French. But for the people who are living there, none of these things really matter. And my novel starts because the thing that matters to me in writing historical fiction is that so much historical fiction is written about the court. It is written about the real people who appear in the history books. It is written about the kings and the queens and the generals and the popes, and in other parts of the world, of course, the imams and the Sufis and the rabbis. But what about us? And forgive me if there are kings and queens in this audience. But what I want to know about is not just the big moments of history, the moments when the edicts were signed, when the first bullet was fired, the things that make the history books. What about the lives of everybody else? If you like, the ordinary lives that become extraordinary because they're set against the backdrop of war. And one of the reasons that I suppose I am a historical novelist, and one of the reasons that this novel sequence matters so much to me about a diaspora novel, 300 years of diaspora and leaving your home, is that when I was a baby publisher, and I was a publisher before I was a writer, I published an author called Slavenka Drkulic. And she was a professor at the university in Zagreb. And her first name, Slavenka, is Croatian, and her surname, Drkulic, is Serbian, and she was separated and divorced from her husband. And I wanted to publish her collection of writings translated into English, and this is what I was working her with. And she had come over to the UK to work on the book, and she was elegant and assured and comfortably off, if you like, and she was a professor. And then about 2 weeks into that piece of work, I was standing with her in London, and she was on the phone to her daughter, because the war had broken out. And she went in 2 weeks from being a professor at a university to being a refugee on a border. Now, some of you in this audience will have suffered and been in those war zones, or have served, or have, like my father, have relatives that have served. And we are here at the wonderful Chalk Valley Literary Festival, History Festival, and you are learning all about those engagements, and we are all passionate about that history. But for me, it taught me that one thing, that we are lucky when it's not us. And we are lucky that it's not here. And so I know now that that's what set me on the path of writing the story of ordinary people who have no control over the history that happens to them. And so the First War begins in 1562. And Catherine de' Medici, you will all know, she gets a bad press often. Women in history often do. And she might be the most evil person in history. She might be a misunderstood person in history. She might be an unsung saint of history. You will all have your views on that. And she is not someone who appears in my novel, because there's enough about her and those people in the novel. But there was a particular edict, the Edict of Saint-Germain, the Edict of January, the Edict of Toleration. There are so many edicts, and most of them have more than one name. But it was supposed to just try and bring an uneasy peace and to stop the, if you like, the bickering that was happening. I mean, it was lethal, fatal bickering, but nonetheless, it really was about control at court as well as issues of doctrine in the country. But it hadn't quite yet been passed, this edict. And so therefore, there is this idea that the single engagement that led to the wars of religion, that started the sequence of the wars of religion, was it binding? We will never know whether it was binding. And we will never know exactly what happens. This is the very famous picture of the massacre at Vassy. But what we do know is this, that when you write a historical novel, my girl, Minou, goes to work as normal. She walks down the street in La Bastide in Carcassonne, where she lives. She has a father who she loves, who is out of sorts, and she doesn't know what has happened to him. He's not the same since he returned from his travels. He is a bookseller. He is a Catholic, but he believes that people can be trusted. And so in his shop, he stocks all sorts of books. And he stocks a lot of stolen, looted Protestant texts from England, as it then was. He stocks Catholic texts. He stocks Jewish texts, and indeed Muslim texts. And Minou goes to work as usual, and she says hello to her Catholic neighbors. She's a Catholic, and they are Catholics. She says hello to her Protestant neighbors, because they're her friends. And she says hello to her Jewish converso neighbors, because they have fled over the border, over the Pyrenees, into Carcassonne. And although one must be careful as a novelist not to over-romanticize this idea that everybody before that date was living in harmony, at the same time, as we have seen in almost every engagement and every talk that you will go to here, there are tipping moments at which all of us who are just there suddenly find that we are redefined in terms that we did not choose. We did not choose to be seen as Catholic. We do not choose to be seen as Protestant. We just are ourselves. And she does not know Minou when she goes into the bookshop and opens up in the morning and the story starts and she gets a mysterious letter and it begins a trail of where are her origins, who are her parents, what is going to happen in France. All of these stories, it's an adventure story. It's a story of betrayal and love and 300 years of a feud, and the story starts in the bookshop. But she does not know that hundreds of miles away, the Duke of Guise, who is a hero in a way to France and certainly to the Catholics, is about to come across a group of Huguenot women, men, and children worshipping in their temple outside the city walls of Vassy, because that was only where they were allowed to do, or in private dwellings. And something will happen, and most of the people in that temple, in the matter of an hour, will be dead. And she does not know that because of that, the wars of religion will start. And she does not know, therefore, that soon she will no longer be able to be herself or stay in Carcassonne, and she will have to flee. Now, one of the things about writing historical fiction, in the same way that all of us who read it and read the real history alongside it, is you have to be very careful that you do not put 21st century eyes into a 16th century girl. You have to be very careful that you do not use your characters as a mouthpiece for things that you think should be obvious now, but were not obvious then. You have to remember what religion meant and why it matters so much, and the texture and structure of all of life. But at the same time, when you're writing historical fiction, you know, as readers, as well as I know as a writer, that when you are a 19-year-old girl who loves your father, and you hear the sound of the hilt of a soldier's sword banging on the door, the thing that she will feel is the same that any of us would feel. What would we do to protect our family? What would we do to protect the people that we love? How would we stand against this unstoppable force of history? And so I then move forward into May, and into that's that one, and that's the Duke of Guise. And now we're in, I move forward to Toulouse in May 1562, and the wars of religion are now happening. And the reason that I moved to Toulouse is, one, because all my fiction are love letters to Languedoc and to Carcassonne and Toulouse, but secondly because every time you're trying to write fiction as opposed to a history, history, I think there is a responsibility to tell all the things that happened and then to interpret them or to reveal them for the reader. In historical fiction, you don't have to do that. You have to read it and you have to know it and understand it. But what you're always doing is finding your way into the story. What would your people be doing? Not the big sweep of history, but the tiny, domestic, intimate sweep of history. And so to discover that, you know, there I think there's a very great writer on the Huguenot period. For me, a man called Mark Greengrass, he was at the University of Sheffield, and indeed may still be at the University of Sheffield, or may indeed be in this audience, in which case I will be mortified and he better come up here. But he wrote a brilliant book about the engagement in Toulouse and the way that before the most famous engagement of the Wars of Religion, which is, of course, the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in 1572, there had been a huge massacre in Toulouse where in the space of 5 days, 4,000 people were murdered. And it's these things that when you write haunt you, because again, you could be in the chamber where the edicts are being signed, where the soldiers are being told where they must go, where the engagement is being planned. Or you can be in a house in Toulouse as you hear the battle come closer. And that, again, for me, is what I think historical fiction can do so, so well, because it helps us to stand in other people's shoes. And this engagement went on 1562 to 1563, and Catherine de Medici, she restored peace in an uneasy way by the Edict of Amboise. And it was, you know, things were not quite as good as they'd been before for the Huguenots, but there was still an uneasy peace. It was still kind of there. And the Parlement de Paris decided not to ratify it until the young prince, Charles IX, Catherine de Medici was his regent, came of age. And then finally, he became king in his own right. And the thought for me of that, the idea that a boy of 13 is suddenly in charge, well, that's a scary thought on top of all the other things that you might think about it when you think of how young some of the people were making the decisions. But for my characters, the next period, the period after the end of the First War, is a peaceful one. And what it was a challenge for me with doing this is that having read all the histories of the Wars of Religion, the Burning Chambers is set in 1562 and in 1862, the end of the sequence and the beginning of the novel. So obviously I am now moving into writing the next one, which is the City of Tears, which is taking part in the period we're coming to. But it is also the same idea of the forces of history, the idea of what wonderful Hilary Mantel in her Wreath lectures, and indeed I think some great biographers like Claire Tomalin, talk about the light, the chinks in history, the bits that we don't know, which of course is where then the historical novelist can come in, because that's when imagination plays its part. Not changing the history, not in any way ever mucking about with the dates or what happened, but sometimes you just have to step into that patch of light where you do not quite know what happened. And for the most part, for the ordinary people, particularly the unannotated women's lives, we can only imagine, and we don't know because they were not recording for themselves and they were not recorded. And the Duke of Guise dies. He dies in 1563, and he is succeeded by his eldest son. And this is very important because this is where, if you like, there could have been one war, there could have been indeed the bought peace, and there could have been an attempt to find an uneasy way of living side by side. but his son is much more forceful, and they believe that it's an assassination. And they don't, there is mistrust on both sides. And we go into a period that is known as the armed peace between 63 and 67, which is not, it isn't peace as we would hope for it to be, but it is not full-scale war. There is no actual raising the revenues for the war. But there was going on at this stage the propaganda war. And it leads, of course, very quickly into what we call the Second War. And the great Protestant thinker of France at this stage, I would say Jeanne d'Albret, who really ran an alternative court. She was Huguenot, she was Protestant, and she, of course, had been right down in Pau and then in Nérac running her court, and many of the Huguenots who had fled there. And she wrote herself and was a very profound thinker, I would say. And I don't know, but I always imagine quite austere. When you look at the picture of Catherine de' Medici and you look at Jeanne, you always think, in a way, they sum up everything about the Catholic-Protestant conflict. And she now, in the Second War, goes to La Rochelle. And La Rochelle is one of the great Huguenot cities. And one of the terms of the settlements with the Huguenots that went backwards and forwards was that there were set cities that were Huguenot states, and then there was allowed to be private worship, in particular private homes, of course, and sometimes on Protestant noblemen's estates. But it's interesting that she is the de facto leader of the Huguenot. It's not a resistance, but the Huguenot tribe, if you like, because there are men. And there is indeed her own son, Henri, who will become the first Bourbon king of France in 1598, the great Henri Quatre, the Vert Galant, as he's known. But it's interesting that actually at this moment it coalesces around her. And the leader of the military side of it is Condé, and he will die a few years later at the Battle of Jarnac. But it will, all of this will keep going. Nothing is resolved. There is a sense that something is going to happen. Something big is going to happen. Now, of course, we can see all of this with the benefit of hindsight. And you can see why some historians don't entirely agree on how many wars there were. Because did the war ever really end? But the edicts sit there as punctuation, if you like, all the way through. The Third War really is just waiting to happen. The edict that stopped the Second War pleases nobody. The Third War breaks out. And one of the things that is interesting for this moment, of course, you have, there's the Protestant Reformation has been going on in England, as it still is, and of course in the Lowlands, in Utrecht, Holland and Zeeland. You obviously have different princes in Europe. Spain is very much supporting the Catholic side of things. It is, of course, all about power and who has control, and all of the royal families are still interconnected. And it's about money, because much of Europe has been under war for a long time and the coffers are empty. And when Condé dies, the great Coligny takes over as the leader of the Huguenot forces. And it looks for a while as if there might be not quite a battle of equals, but actually there might be a sense of old-fashioned warfare where certain territories will be taken, certain territories will be lost. And there might come to an accommodation where everybody would agree that nobody would quite win this war. You know, in the tent next door, they're talking about why did the First World War not end earlier? And of course, the pattern of war is it precisely that. There's a moment at which both sides do not believe it is worth their while continuing. And so there we have the first thing. They are known as the early wars, the first, second, and third. And it might have ended. For my family living through this, Minou Joubert and her family, and the baddie family, if you like, the one with whom she is going to be at feud for these 300 years and her descendants, they have been living quietly. They have gone to the mountains. And the thing that is significant about this moment is that many people who are Huguenots and Catholics are ignoring their leaders. When you're down in Languedoc, it is a more Huguenot tolerant area, but that is the nature of that part of France, you might say. And so not much has come that way. Much of the fighting has been up in the north and the east and around the big cities. And what really is at stake at this point, at the end of the early wars? It's really about citizenship. It's about, if you are Huguenot, are you loyal to France? If the king is the embodiment of France, the divine right of kings, but particularly in France, that idea of the figure of the king is France herself, then can you be a true citizen, or are you the enemy within? And of course, we know in civil wars, this is often really what it comes down to. Can you be loyal to God and to church and to king and to state? And the other thing that I think is very important at this moment as we move towards the most famous engagement, which will really change the tone of everything that happens, is the idea that at this moment, although there are very, very, I hesitate to use the word fanatics, because I think that sometimes does a disservice to people of very strong religious principle and belief, but there are people on the outside who are very, very fervent and devout on either side, for whom no accommodation will ever be acceptable. But I think at this moment, I would say, for many, many people in between, they would like accommodation. They would like to be finding a way to not be fighting, for their sons not to be dying, for the women in the towns not to be doing everything because there are no boys left. But then, this happens. And this really is where the tone changes, I would say. Many of the atrocities are attributed mostly to the Catholic side in the early wars. After this point, it starts to become a war of attrition on both sides. And this is something that has been set up between the two women, these two great queens, Jeanne d'Albret, the great Protestant queen, and Catherine de' Medici, the great French queen. And they have set up a match between the son, Henri IV, Henri of Navarre, as he then is, and one of the daughters of Catherine de' Medici, Margot, as she's often represented, Marguerite. And it's going to be the greatest wedding of all time. And there is this sense that everybody will go to Paris and all the leadership of the Huguenots will be there and all the Catholics will be there. And I love this in this story, that these two very strong women in a world of men tried to broker the peace by a marriage, but it did not work. The marriage happened. Marguerite really didn't fancy him in the slightest, either as her husband or indeed general terms. There's a lot of writings about the fact that he stank of garlic, that he had terrible southern habits, that he could fell an ox at 12 paces from all the garlic he always chewed. He was a famous womanizer, he liked his drink, he lived life to the full, and he looked like a man of the mountains. And he is very, very romanticized in French history, but he does sound a wonderful man in some respects. And he was a Protestant, and he followed his mother's religion, which had not been his father's religion, but he was ready to do this. Marguerite was a bit of a monkey, shall we say. She's also had a bad press. She behaved no worse than her brothers, but she has obviously been more condemned for it. She had various lovers, not least of all within the Guise family, and she did not want to marry him, but they did it. And on the 18th of August, 1572, they married. And then in the street, Coligny was shot. We will never know again whether that was an assassination, whether Guise was behind it, whether Catherine de' Medici was behind it, whether anyone was behind it, whether it was just a random assassin. We do know the house that he was supposedly sheltering in was owned by the Guise family. We will never know, not for sure. But what happens is essentially retaliation. And on the 23rd and the 24th of August, whether there was a proper sign given or not, there is a massacre where essentially almost all the Huguenot leadership is wiped out. There is that moment when the bells start to ring out. There is the moment when certain lights have been left at window to show a Catholic household rather than a Huguenot dwelling. There are white crosses painted on the doors. And it is the most astonishing and appalling bloodbath. And almost nobody escapes. Henry escapes. A few people escape, but mostly that is the end. They are wiped out. It is very hard to read that and not feel that that was a deliberate ambush, that it was not a deliberate assassination. But again, with many of these things, there are so many motives attributed to many different people about what might have been happened. Did somebody give the signal, or was it that moment? Who will rid me of this troublesome priest? As a historical novelist, it's not that it does not matter, but it's not the story that I'm telling. My family are in Paris. They are really excited to be in Paris. They are a family of Catholics and Protestants. They have gone to see the wedding of a generation. And as I'm writing that now, I don't know who will get out. And for me as a novelist, that's again what it's about, is the idea that when we read history, we don't know until we've read the history what actually happens in the record. When you're writing a novel and you're reading a novel, it's the same thing. That they go in good faith, my Joubert family and the other family, they go to Paris in good faith. But not all of them survive and not all of them leave. And of course, this then leads to really essentially Protestant Catholic pogroms throughout France. And over the next few weeks and months, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, the record doesn't agree, of Huguenots are massacred. There are copycat massacres all over France, including in Toulouse. And so, of course, we very immediately are into the Fourth War. And in the City of Tears, in the Fourth War, this period of time, my family are no longer in France. And you can see from this wonderful map that already you're starting to see, after the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, whereas before most of the leading Huguenots had stayed put, not all, but almost all of them had stayed put, already people are starting to say, but I love my family more. I love my family more than I love France. I don't want to be driven out. It's my country too, but I'm not prepared to risk it. And so my family by that stage will be in the great refugee city of Amsterdam. The later wars of religion, which I've just done there, just so you can see how they happen, because I'm going to canter through them a bit. The Fifth War, again, almost everything that stops and starts these sequence of wars, it's not really doctrinal anymore. It is about territory. It is about who's leading whom. It is about who's got the bigger forces. Charles IX, who was a really very inadequate person all round by the sounds of things, he dies, and then Henri of Anjou takes over, his brother, and he becomes Henry III. And there's a little moment, and then there is the Sixth War, and then there is the Seventh War. And then you come to the most significant war. And as a historical novelist, if I wrote every war, you would be bored, because that's not what you read a novel for. When you read the real history, you know, the great history books, another great book that I've really found incredibly helpful reading is by Geoffrey Treasure. And it's a big sweeping history of the Huguenot diaspora and the conflict. I love reading everything, all the detail about what happened in each of the sequences, but as a novelist, horribly, as so often in war, it's more of the same. A little bit of ground gained, a lot of lost ground. More people dead, nothing really changing, and just going on and on, this attritional round in a circle. And then we come to the War of the Trois Henries, and this is one of the things that is so confusing. Not only are there so many edicts in this period of history, many of them with more than one name, but there are an awful lot of Henrys. So you have Henry of Guise, and you have Henry III, and you have Henry of Navarre, and they are the three Henrys, and this is how they are known. And it's this moment, though, there is this sense. It's very easy to see this with the benefit of hindsight, but actually there is the sense, I think, when you read the record and you're in the archives and you read the history, of the end of days, that with Henry III, Henri of Anjou, as he was before, this is coming to the end of the dying Valois dynasty, and there is soon to be a new dynasty on the throne. And Henri of Guise is assassinated, and then the assassination of Henri III of France. And then on his deathbed, Henry III, he names his Protestant rival as the man he wants to take over. He says Henry of Navarre should be the king after me, but he begs him to convert to Catholicism in order to bring peace to France. As a novelist, just imagine, as a playwright, just imagine, after all of that time, those families, the dying man anoints his arch enemy. And that is one of the things that, of course, is why the wars of religion are so engaging, and why everybody, whether they are historians or playwrights or filmmakers or novelists like me, want to set stories against this backdrop. Because actually, it's that Goncourt story. History could have been a novel that might be a piece of real history. You just no longer can tell as he anoints him. And then there is this extraordinary moment as well in 1589 when Catherine de' Medici finally dies. and that is the last letting go. She has done everything to keep her sons and her family as the rulers of France, and she dies then as well. And then Henri, he is now anointed king, but Catholic France doesn't want him. And it's known as the Conquête du Rhône, the conquest of the kingdom. And you have this sort of sense that essentially Henry, he held the west and the south, those sort of more radical areas of France, as I tend to think of them. And the Catholic lead, which is now holding north and east of France, and the wars continue. And so although King Henry should be King Henri IV, the Catholics will not accept him. And the war carries on, and it carries on, and more people die. And in my period of history in Carcassonne, between 1590 and 1592, there is an actual illustration of what is happening in France, in that by this stage, the Bastide, the modern town, and the medieval city are at war with each other. So the medieval city of Carcassonne that I write about in Labyrinth is Catholic, and the Bastide that I write about in The Burning Chambers is now Protestant. So there is a mini micro civil war going on just in Carcassonne, and it's not the only city. And then finally comes the conversion. In inverted commas, the conversion. My family, the Jouberts, are in Amsterdam. Their rivals are in London, and are in the Holy Roman Empire, or Germany, as you could call it. And at this moment, he realizes that he will never take Paris if he remains a Protestant. And he has been crowned in Chartres, and he's been getting closer and closer. So finally, he says the words that I suppose are the most famous of his words of all, which is, Paris vaut bien une messe. Paris is well worth a mass. And he converts, and once he has converted, he, of course, signs the Edict of Nantes, and religious toleration is given, in the end, to the Huguenots of France, the French Protestants. And although it is not perfect, of course, it does not give quite identical rights. What it does is essentially say, you are French, and we are French. And you have the right to work in these areas and to own this land and to worship as you see fit. And the thing that I think is so sad about this, I suppose, is what would have happened if he had not been assassinated. Because I feel, having read all of this history and started to tell stories set against the backdrop of the real history, that he might have done it, you know. He might have done it. And it might have been that that would be the end. Because the one thing that we do know about the Huguenots, and there may be descendants in the audience, I am not, but every country that the Huguenots fled to was enriched by their presence. Every country that has a story of welcoming the Huguenots is proud of that. And every time I've done, this is my 55th event around the Burning Chambers in the past 2 months, and every audience, someone has come up and said they're a Huguenot, and they are proud to be so. And France was the poorer by getting rid of them. And although they were never more than 10% of the French population, they were disproportionately represented in the areas of medicine, of engineering, of bookselling, of the law, of all of those. It was an urban religion, much more than in the country, and it was in the cities. And it was inclined to tolerance more than a more traditional form of Catholicism that was in the countryside. And the remaining chronology, as you can see, he is assassinated by, as he's always described in the books, as a deranged monk. But who knows if he was actually deranged. He was a monk, so that's something. Louis XIII comes. The Siege of La Rochelle is one of the most famous turning points, of course, as this is the end of Huguenot political autonomy. And then the accession of Louis XIV. And it is, of course, Louis XIV, the grandson of the great Henri IV, who will sign the Edict of Fontainebleau, which is more usually, of course, known as the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. And it is deadly, because at that moment, it's illegal. and they have to leave. And that is when the diaspora happened completely. And everything is changing in Europe because, of course, Elizabeth I has died in 1603 and James has come to the throne. And I think that you can see that it's the end of one nature of history, the sort of cadence, the music of one type of history. And we are there in a totally different and beginning of a new type of history. But I'm long gone by then, because my descendants have gone to where this story for me started, which is in Franschhoek in South Africa. And the reason the story started there was I was at a book festival. Not like this one's special, but a book festival in this place called Franschhoek. Knew nothing about it. I was being taken in to the town through Stellenbosch in the winelands. And as we were going through, I suddenly looked and I saw at the sides of the road that there was a sign that said Languedoc. It was spelt with a Q, but Languedoc is the region I write about in France, and I didn't know what to think. And then we went a bit further, and I started to notice when I looked around, all the wine farms had French names, not Cosa names, not Afrikaans names, not English names, but French names. La Provence, La Motte, Le Petit Provence. And then I got to the main street, and I saw the sign. And the sign said, Huguenot Street. And so then I thought I better ask somebody. So I asked my lovely person looking after me, I said, what is this? And she said, oh, didn't you know that the word Franschhoek means the French corner? And so I ran then pretty much to the museum, the Huguenot Museum at the end of the road. And I went in and I did a very English thing. And I said, you know, here's my credit card. Admit one, please, to the Huguenot Museum. And they looked at me and said, we don't take credit cards. And I said, well, you know, can you let me in? They said, no, come back tomorrow with some money. I said, I'm only in town for the day. And he looked at me and he said, oh, are you a writer? And I said, yes, I'm a writer. And he said, oh, if you're a writer, you can come in for free. And writers are good at getting in for free. Anyway, so in I went, nobody there. It was a beautiful Dutch Cape house. And I walked around this lovely museum, creaking floorboards, a clay, you know, one of those case clocks that was ticking backwards and forwards. Saw beautiful, beautiful models of the ships, all of the Dutch East India story, and learned that what had happened was the Dutch East India Company, who had obviously taken the land from the people who owned it, and had set up the Cape of Good Hope as a trading post and a fueling station. And so they were sailing everything round from Rotterdam and Amsterdam and The Hague all the way around the Bay of Biscay and the Canary Islands, stopping to refuel at the Cape and then going on to their territories in the east. They suddenly realized that the land in South Africa in the Cape was very similar to the land in Languedoc in the southwest of France. And so they then thought, if there are in our city, in all of those refugees, winemakers from Languedoc in France who might be prepared to travel, then we will pay for their passage on a ship, Dutch East India ship. We will pay for their families to go with them. We will pay for a French pastor to minister to them to go. And then I got to the back room of that museum, and there was a list of the 180 Huguenots who had been brave enough to accept that invitation and had sailed after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, including one on a ship that landed on the 4th of August, 1688, in the Cape. It was called the Berg China. And when I looked down that list, I saw the name of a family that I had written about in my novel, Labyrinth. And then I thought, don't do this, Kate. You know nothing about South Africa, and of course it's a minefield. You know nothing about the Huguenots, and that's probably a minefield. You don't even know enough to know if it's a minefield. It's not your period of history, the 16th, 17th, 18th century, not, you know, you do medieval, and then you go to Fin de Siècle. That's your thing. And I stepped outside. And then I looked up at the mountains, the Franschhoek Mountains, and they are beautiful. And I suddenly thought, what would it be if you had been a refugee? What would it have meant if you had grown up hearing stories of how your family was forced to leave the place you loved in the 16th century. And your grandmother and your great-grandmother and her great-grandmother before her told all of these stories. And they had told you stories of home. And of course, that's what the Greek word nostalgia means, a longing for home. And you had therefore in your mind, even though you had never been there, and it had never been your home, that sense of the blue sky of Languedoc and the mountains of the Pyrenees and the Garrigue and that hot, hot wind that comes down the Tramontana and the Serres in Languedoc and meshes everything up and the rows of vines when you look down to the sea. What if you, your descendants, 300 years later, found themselves here in Franschhoek as refugees in a land you didn't know, with people speaking a language you did not understand. But then you looked up at those mountains and they looked like home. They looked like the home you'd been told about. And just maybe you would feel, you know, we could live here. It could be all right here. And at that moment, I thought, I'd better go and buy myself a book about the Huguenots. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.